This is the KPTZ Compass, your local news magazine for the Northeast Olympic Peninsula. This week on the Compass, we talk with bird rescuer extraordinaire Cindy Daly about the mysterious deaths of hundreds of rhinoceros auklets in the Strait of Juan de Fuca and what to do if you encounter a sick seabird. And the Peace Walkers come to Port Townsend for the second time this year, this time to commemorate the nuclear bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So now let's go inside the Compass. On a walk along North Beach a few weeks back, my family came upon a sad sight, a sick seabird lying on a piece of plywood, gasping for breath. It was a rhinoceros auklet, a close relative of the puffin, with a small horn-like projection above its bill that gives it its name. Because we had found a sick and emaciated common murre on the beach the year before, we knew what to do. We wrapped the bird in a shirt and took it straight to Cindy Daly, who, with the help of her husband, former Port Townsend Police Chief Connor Daly, runs an amazing operation called Discovery Bay Wild Bird Rescue, which was the subject late last summer of a full Compass feature story. Along our way back down the beach to our car, we noticed another rhinoceros auklet lying dead on the cobbles. It was just a few days later that I saw the headline in Peninsula Daily News. Scientists look for answers as hundreds of dead birds wash ashore along the Strait of Juan de Fuca. What kind of birds? Rhinoceros auklets. Cause of death? Unknown. Deep into the article, there was a line that gave me pause. Coastal Observation and Seabird Survey Team Executive Director Julia Parrish cautioned the public not to go near sick birds or to try to help them. Had we been foolhardy to bring the bird in? I wondered what Daly would have to say on the subject. Then last week there was a follow-up story that said that scientists were closing in on the cause of the auklet's deaths, bacterial pneumonia and/or starvation. Again, there was a warning. It was unknown whether the pneumonia was contagious to humans. Well, my family and I had survived, for what that's worth. I decided to go talk with Daly. And so it was that I dropped in on Daly Saturday morning as she was preparing a breakfast of mealworms for some of the patients in her bird infirmary, a converted two-car garage. I started off asking about the bird we had brought in.
I was wondering, first of all, what happened with our bird?
Well, it was definitely in distress, and I could tell that it was having difficulty breathing. So it did seem like a kind of a pneumonia because you could hear the gurgling in its lungs as it was breathing. And I brought it in and started to just get it warm and comfortable, and of course it died shortly thereafter. So I didn't have much time to do anything for that bird. And you had mentioned that there were others, you know, dead around it when
you
found it.
Yeah, we actually found, well, we saw one other, and other people on the beach reported that they'd seen a couple of dead. So, yeah, there were some around there. So, the Peninsula Daily News article said that they're suspecting now that the birds are starving, although they also seem to have pneumonia, and they're not sure which is coming. But the bird that we brought you didn't seem like it was starving, did it?
No, the bird that you brought in was actually a healthy adult. It was not starved, and it was, you know, you could see that it was in breeding plumage. It was just a normal, healthy adult auklet.
Have you seen other auklets? I mean, have people been bringing you others recently?
I have received a couple others that, actually two others. One came in with the same symptoms that yours had, was having difficulty breathing, and it died shortly after getting here. But I also received one that the Northwest Raptor Center got from the Port Angeles Spit, and they got that bird in, and that bird is just very thin and did not have any problems with breathing. It seemed mostly just starving, and didn't see any other symptoms with that one. And that one actually has responded quite well to our treatment. It came here right after they received it. They normally send birds here because I'm set up for aquatic birds. I've got special housing for them with I have built-in pools, 300-gallon pools that have filtration systems just for them. So I'm set up for aquatic birds. So they send them to me, and I have been successfully able to bring that bird back around, and it's doing quite well now.
Well, it's good news.
Yes.
So
it didn't need any more than just, you know, extra vitamins and being fed properly and getting what it needed to just help it past its emaciation.
That's wonderful. So there's another thing that really sort of confused me, because, you know, we thought nothing of just picking that auklet up and bringing him into you, because, you know, we knew that you were the person who might be able to do something for it. But the article in the Peninsula Daily News quoted scientists as saying that that was the wrong thing to do, that, you know, like the public should avoid touching sick birds on the beach. Now, what do you think about that?
Well, I would not tell anyone to do anything that would put them in harm's way, of course. So I guess my message would be that, you know, in that article, I think they were speaking to a survey team that does survey the dead birds that are on our shores, and they're just keeping track year after year, and it is associated with the university, which is great, and it's good information. And I'm in no position to tell people exactly what's going on with them, because I think we're hearing a lot of different things. So I would just say that I am in a position as a wildlife rehabilitator. I'm licensed to take in wildlife, and would recommend that they just, I don't think in that article that they knew that at that time that I was a resource. So use me as a resource. Give me a phone call. Let me know that the birds are there. If there's a live bird, I'd certainly like to try to see if it could be saved. And if that's possible, and they don't want, and someone sees it, if they just want to call and let us know, we'll send someone out there if we can. Now, remember, we're so busy right now. This is our busiest time of the year, but we'll do our best to get out and assess the situation and pick up the birds if we can ourselves. If someone is willing to take the bird and, you know, wrap it up in a towel or something, even a coat, a light coat, whatever they happen to have with them, and have something to wrap it in and put it in something and want to bring it here, that would be great too. And just remember, it's this time of year, I'm not just seeing auklets coming in on the beaches. I don't want people to walk past that common murre or a pigeon guillemot that may just have some kind of other injury that could benefit from our rehabilitation efforts.
Last year, also on my wife's birthday, we were out on the beach and we found an emaciated common murre that we brought in here. That you successfully nursed back to health, and at that time you told us that one thing that people should not do when they find a bird, a seabird in distress on the beach, is put the bird back in the water.
That's correct, because if they're on the beach, they've beached themselves, there's something wrong. And it could be that they have been attacked by a predator, and they have, oftentimes I'll see them with a laceration. They may have been in the claws of some eagle, and then for some reason, maybe they bite the bird and the bird drops them and they're on the beach with a laceration. That's something that we might be able to do something about, fix, you know, get that sutured and get that bird nurse back to health and put them back out there. Youngsters this time of year, somehow they end up on the beach because they're not getting enough nutrition. There's not enough fish out there, whatever the problems are. And we can certainly build those guys back up and put them back out there. So seabirds have been under a lot of pressure year after year after year from lots of different things. And I have a big interest in seabirds and want to do all that I can to get as many back out as possible.
How is this year comparing to past years in terms of, you know, starving birds coming in?
Well, year after year, we've been hearing about, you know, the algae blooms and the toxins and the different things that are affecting our seabirds, the lack of food out there, several El Nino years in a row, all affecting their ability to find food. And we've certainly been hearing that for the past 3 years at least. And so I know that the pressures out there for them have increased. And so naturally we have to worry about their numbers. And, you know, one thing about seabirds, they typically only have one egg a year. They lay one egg, maybe two, depending on the species, but they invest all of their effort in that one chick. So, you know, you can imagine that to reproduce and keep their numbers up, you know, with these pressures going on has got to be taking its toll.
Right. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
If you wish to report on or bring in a sick or injured bird, you can reach Cindy Daly at Discovery Bay Wild Bird Rescue by phone at area code 360-379-0802. That phone number again is 360-379-0802. This is Steve Evans reporting for KPTZ Community Radio News. For the second time this year, the first being Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday in January, a banner-bearing brigade of Walkers for Peace set out last Friday morning from the county park opposite the entrance to Naval Magazine Indian Island, the largest exporter of armaments on the West Coast, to Port Townsend, as just one leg of a much longer peace walk under the leadership of Senji Kaneda, the Nipponzan Miyahoji Buddhist monk who, in collaboration with the Ground Zero Center for Nonviolent Action, has organized and led similar peace walks for more than a dozen years. Although the occasion for the march this time was in one sense historic, it marked the anniversary of the nuclear bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It was also tragically current, as the toll of international warfare has this year reached all-time peaks, with some 65.3 million persons worldwide now forcibly displaced by warfare, an historic high according to the United Nations High Commission on Refugees, and with one party's candidate for president for the first time ever calling the other unfit to hold the key that, in a moment's notice, could unlock the destructive power of more than 17,000 Hiroshimas, this small band was walking to represent the common sense point of view that humanity must soon find ways to settle its differences without resort to violence. Out of respect for the peace walkers, I decided not to interview them again this time about their motivation for marching, but here reprised excerpts of the report from the January march on the occasion of Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday, for many of the walkers were the same, although this time it was a smaller group and not all of the voices you will hear were present this time around. I fell in line behind David Berrien, whom I knew to be a member of the Buddhist Peace Fellowship in Port Townsend. He was wearing a bright orange reflective vest with built-in backpack, on which I noticed a black badge with yellow lettering in what appeared to be Arabic. I asked him about it.
It says Iraq Peace Team.
So tell me the story about that.
This is, the end of 2002, the beginning of 2003. And of course, this is a time when the United States had been saying to the country and to the people of Iraq, it'll be shock and awe anytime now.
Absolutely.
Because we're going to go in there and get the weapons of mass destruction. Right after Christmas of 2002, I got this email from Buddhist Peace Fellowship saying, we've got these two people that were going to be part of a delegation to Iraq, but they've come down with asthma. They thought, Iraq is not the place to go if you're sick because of the economic sanctions that had essentially severely reduced any kind of medical equipment or medical supplies. And it really spoke to me because during that time, Christmas time, holiday time, I'm with my family, and I wondered how the people in Iraq, what are they telling their children about why this shock and awe was going to happen? It seemed to me that, okay, this is my time.
What was your career? I mean, what was going on in your life at this time?
I had had a job, worked for the city of Seattle. All my kids had grown up and they were doing fine. And to me, it was like, hey, I got this job, I've got stability, I've got my health. This is a time to step forward on something like this. And so I applied and got accepted, and within 2 weeks, I was on my way to Baghdad to witness the effect of the economic sanctions that had on families and children there, where, in fact, by that time, the United Nations was saying over 500,000 children had died.
500,000? Really?
Yes, really. And that was backed up by other studies by John Hopkins University and others. And it's not a matter of, you know, they were being shot because, you know, the active war wasn't happening quite so much, although it was a lot more than people realized. But it came from the fact that one of the things that was prohibited from being imported was chlorine for sterilizing drinking water, just like we have. Things you don't normally think of in terms of what war is really about.
So what did you do when you were in Baghdad? I mean, what was your function there?
To a large extent, it was being a witness to what was there. Doing vigils in front of the UN compound, where at that time you still had UN inspectors trying to verify that there were no weapons of mass destruction. And actually for years they had verified that and kept verifying it despite what our government leaders were saying. I mean, I didn't know how we would be received. But we had a sheet in Arabic and in English that told why we were there as witnesses to their situation. And as soon as I saw that, it was an overwhelming welcome from everyone. You'd be invited into their shop. Oh, they'll go out on the street and get tea and bring it in for you. The idea of shock and awe and the people of Iraq felt very personal to me at that time. And I found myself really distressed at a very basic level of that this should ever happen. It's like, I've just got to do something about this.
When you participate in a march like the one today, what do you hope from it?
I do it for myself. I need to show up. I need to make choices on an ongoing basis that show to me my continued commitment to using nonviolence, using to stand up for investments in peace and justice. And I do it for others as well. Which is to say, I have met countless times people who have told me that the kinds of issues that I was concerned about, they share those issues too. But in fact, in their church, in their work, in their own family, they didn't feel any support. And so they never talked about it. And that when they had seen me or heard me talk about it, they said, yeah, there's other people like me out there. We've got cars, we've got trucks. Right now there's a bus that's coming by us. And I'm hoping that people in those vehicles are also feeling a support for their own concerns about the endless war that the United States is engaged in, and which many presidential candidates want to expand significantly.
And indeed, as we walked along, many of the drivers passing by waved or tooted their horns in approval. Up ahead, I noticed former Congregationalist United Church of Christ minister Craig Rennebohm, who recently became a Quaker, talking to a friend. I caught up to get his thoughts of the day, and found that he, like many others, was thinking about recent revelations from truthout.org investigative journalist Dar Jamal about Navy plans to turn many local state parks and marinas into training grounds for Navy SEALs.
The fact that the Parks Department issued them a permit saying that the landing of these SEALs is like any other person wanting to land their boat at a state park. And I thought, that's the problem. The notion that the military is no different from a pleasure boat or a classic wooden boat or a sailboat is ridiculous. And what it does to us is, or continues to blend the military and the civilian as if there's no difference between us. And there's a process. If the military needs training spaces, bases, forts, there's a process. They go through the Congress and we appropriate money, we debate the needs, and if this is indeed is a crying need, then it should be discussed among the people, not simply have some park officials say, oh, there's no difference between the military and ordinary citizens using a park. Well, we need to address that sort of creeping militarism into the culture. The fact that a public official can't see a distinction between military and civilian is really troubling.
About half an hour into the walk, we came to a halt opposite the Jefferson County Library for a bathroom break. I took this opportunity to arrange for a short interview with March leader Senji Kanata, the Japanese Buddhist monk who has led dozens of similar peace walks, including one following the route of slaves along the Underground Railroad from Toronto to New York in 1998.
What inspired the notion of peace walks or walks for justice?
And very simple. And Buddha said, most important thing, do not take the life of others. You know, and also respect the life of others because life is most important. We want to pray with the people who wish to realize the better world, better future.
I see. So for you, the walk is actually a form of prayer.
Yeah. One of the way is instead of meditation in the back of the mountain by alone, we are also more like a share to the idea for the better future. Not just only Buddhist, and atheist, Christian, Muslim, everyone, the same, I think, and I believe the same, everybody have a same wish, yeah. So, whatever we can do, just I want to do. This one of the ways, this kind of walk and pray, yeah. Very simple thing. Sometimes I walk alone, sometimes I walk like more many people, and whatever this, I have a chance, I have a time, I wish to walk like this. Yeah.
As we walked, I asked some of the peace walkers, many of whom were veterans of decades of protest dating back to the Civil Rights Movement, the Vietnam War, and the Ground Zero struggle against nuclear weapons, the same question. What did they hope would come of this, and why were they there?
It seems like a fool's errand, but you keep doing it, even if you don't get results. You never know exactly what impact you have. It's a matter of not keeping silent. You can't keep silent, otherwise you acquiesce.
I think it's no one action today. It's this action as part of a long history of standing up to bigotry, racism, discrimination, to militarism, to all of the things that make for poverty. We do that day in and day out. This march just simply highlights what must be a daily witness and practice for all of us to address these issues.
To let people know how important it is to me to get rid of nuclear weapons and build peace in the world. It's very important not to be tied to results, because I don't know the... I've often found out much later that there were results when I thought there were not.
Can't really just sit around and talk. If you want things to change, you have to show people by using your time and your energy that you're really committed to change. And I think it actually also helps people sort of think and process. And on these walks, you meet people and you exchange ideas, and it helps people sort of clarify what needs to be done for themselves.
So what's your name?
Star Gilmartin. I'm from Maine.
From Maine?
Maine, yes.
Did you come here for this?
Yes, I do peace walks in Maine, and the person who was leading the walk, Sanjay Kanata, invited me to come here, and he's participated in peace walks with us in Maine for 2 of the 4 years I've been doing it.
So what do you hope for from your peace walks?
I think a lot of it is just we're speaking to the communities. We walk through our communities and we meet with people in Maine, and we talk about the issues that are important to us about peace, basically. There are many people who will stop and say, thank you for doing what you're doing. You know, you're a voice in the wilderness, because they feel isolated. They don't want this military buildup that the U.S. has been embarking on for many, many years, the military-industrial complex. And people really know, they know that that's coming at an expense to them, at a cost to them. So I'm a social worker, so certain programs are being cut so that money can be spent on the Trident submarine. We live in a very conservative state of Maine. And, you know, a lot of people will come out and say, you know, thank you for doing this, because we just didn't realize that other people felt the same way as I do.
Counting breaks for lunch and a mid-afternoon snack at the food co-op, it took the walkers a total of about 6 hours to cover the 13-mile distance. As they arrived at Pope Marine Park in downtown Port Townsend, they were welcomed by longtime Port Townsend Peace Movement Chairman Doug Milholland.
Peace walkers, welcome to Port Townsend.
Thank you.
We greet you with open arms. And the generous gift of walking from the West Coast's most important weapons transfer depot to Port Townsend, a place where many citizens are wondering, do we really want more militarization of this part of the state?
No.
Do we really want to see the airplanes coming to practice for a possible future war?
No.
A war that could include nuclear weapons?
No.
We call upon Martin Luther King to be with us in our hearts, to deepen our perspectives, so that as we walk forward, we find each other in community, a community that is clear-headed, a community that focuses on hope, the hope that underneath all the masks of corporatism and militarism and consumerism, we are human beings, and we call that birthright, the ability to be human with one another, is strengthened. And we're grateful to the Peace Walkers for having carried that seed to Port Townsend. We're very grateful.
Milholland this time was one of the walkers rather than being a greeter in town. He also, of course, was the peace activist featured on this program recently, who, on Father's Day this year, conducted a one-man sit-in blocking the main entrance to the Indian Island Weapons Transfer Depot, an action for which he will be in court for a second time this week after refusing an offer by District Court Judge Jill Landis on his first court date to let him off easy with a $100 fine for an infraction, which would not qualify him for a jury trial. Milholland wants the court to charge him with at least a misdemeanor so that he can mount a necessity defense before a jury and, as he puts it, put the whole government on trial for war crimes. This is Steve Evans reporting for KPTZ Community Radio News. This week's KPTZ Compass was written and produced by Steve Evans. The Compass airs Mondays and Saturdays at noon, Tuesdays at 5 p.m., and Wednesdays at 10 a.m., exclusively here on KPTZ, the home of eclectic, authentic community radio. For the news team here at KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, I'm Steve Evans.